From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Oral History Special number one. Hello, this is Mark, the producer of the podcast. First, can I wish all of our listeners a very happy new year from me and all of the team. Now, our regular listeners may be expecting the second part of our questions and answers show that we promised you for this month. But as we record this in the third week of January, the UK is in a national lockdown to help contain the spread of coronavirus. Unfortunately, it means it just hasn't been possible for us to record that promised second show. I know many of you will have been waiting to see if your question's been selected, but don't worry, because once it's safe to do so, we will bring you that episode. For now, as we did last year during the first lockdown, we'll endeavour to continue to bring you new episodes of the podcast. With that in mind, we thought back to our VE Day and VJ Day episodes from last year, which, if you remember, included dozens of very short clips from our more than 500 oral history recordings. All of those short little clips were taken from much longer interviews. So, until we can resume our normal service, over the next few episodes, it seems the perfect time to shine a light on a few of those veterans by bringing you the full versions of those interviews in these oral history specials. But first, before the lockdown, I sat down with Bletchley Park's oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne, to talk about why collecting the oral histories of our veterans is so vitally important. I'm sat here again in the archive at Bletchley Park with our oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne. I've got Jonathan with me just to talk about why the oral history is so important. And it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's important for all sorts of reasons. I mean, particularly with the story of Bletchley Park, which wasn't known for so many years. Mm. And then those individual stories were unknown. And it's only in recent, let's say, 20 years at most, that most of the people who worked here and at the other locations connected with Bletchley Park really felt able to talk about it. And of course, in the last 9 years, we've actually gone out and encouraged them to talk to us and record their stories. So I think it's very much making up for lost time while we still can, hearing people's stories, honouring the work they did, but also learning how this place worked, learning the details.
Because there's a few strands, isn't there, to what we're doing. It is partly to say thank you to those veterans for their service, to give them a voice, but the other side of it is it helps us, doesn't it, tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, it's very practical because we have a story to tell when people visit us. And as people who will have come to some of our more recent exhibitions will have seen or indeed heard, we can use extracts from their stories either on sound points where you can actually hear them talking or use the text on panels.
And our next major exhibition that we will be opening at some point in the future, the veterans' oral histories are playing quite a part in that, aren't they?
Yes, they are. One of the areas of Bletchley Park that will feature heavily in this exhibition will be the work of the naval section. And we've been very lucky to have interviewed many veterans who worked in that section on German, Japanese and Italian naval codes and producing intelligence from them. We're also going to look at wider aspects of the Bletchley Park story, for example, recruitment. And many of the interviews that we've done, people talk about how they were recruited. Sometimes it's quite a long process involving several interviews. In other times, it was so short, sharp and sweet that they suddenly found themselves doing the secret work, which they hadn't expected to be doing a few months earlier.
Yeah, the stories of the recruitments kind of fall into two categories, don't they? They're the, I went down to the Labour Exchange and they said, you're going here. Or, you know, oh, someone had a little word with someone and they had a word with me and they sent me a letter and I went for an interview in London and I came back and then I went off here. But both of them normally end up with a railway warrant to Bletchley, don't
That's
they?
Right. And indeed, we have heard what people often think is the typical Bletchley Park recruitment story of being recruited at university by, you know, someone who knew your father or well, that sort of story. We have heard that. And we've heard, as you say, the ones where people report to their Labour Exchange for national service. But one thing all these stories have in common is when they were being interviewed, they weren't told what it was they were being recruited for. And it was only when they got here, and then probably a day or two later, they actually had some inkling of, oh, this is very, very secret.
Yeah, I mean, generally, they would have signed the Official Secrets Act before they were told anything, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, might have said, would you be interested in secret work? But it wouldn't have been any more than that, would it?
Yeah, I do remember one veteran told me that they were given the opportunity to say, you don't have to sign it. We understand if you don't want to, but if you don't sign it, you can't work here. That's fine, but you know, you've got to make your mind up now. And obviously she did sign it and worked here and told us her story more recently.
Does that ever come up in the interviews? Do you ever get veterans say, oh, am I allowed to talk about this?
By the time we get round to interviewing them, usually not. We've sort of done all our persuasion over the phone with the family, perhaps through letters, and made it absolutely clear. And this comes from, you know, the highest possible source from GCHQ itself, that they are allowed to talk about it. And by this time, they're very happy. But they do usually, even in the interview, say, well, I've never talked about it before, or this is the first time I've talked about it. Yeah,
I've done a couple, and, you know, I've done nowhere near as many as you and your brilliant team have. You know, and I've sat in with a couple as well. I don't know, it's kind of an honour to sit there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It is, because you're hearing people talking about what is history and their part in it. And it's also very nice because they are really keen to talk to us. It is an honour indeed, but on the other hand, they're quite almost flattered in some ways that we actually come to see them to hear their story, which is nice. You know, I think we find it interesting, and we always tell the prospective interviewees that interviewees normally enjoy it as much as the interviewers do, and we find that that's the case. Yeah,
it's so important, the work. Thanks again, Jonathan. Let's just hope that 2021 is a better year for us and for your team, and we'll return and you can tell us that you've done dozens and dozens and dozens of interviews.
Well, let's hope so. Thanks, Mark.
So, for the first of these special shows, I've selected Sheila Wilson, who came to Bletchley Park in 1944 to serve in the naval section plotting Allied shipping. Post-war, Sheila had a varied career, including becoming a well-respected filmmaker and film editor, but also later becoming a psychotherapist. I do wonder if that final job may have added to what I think is a quite unique and at times even existential view of her time at GCNCS. For me, this interview is, well, quite simply fascinating. Let's join Jonathan and Sheila back in 2015 when this was originally recorded.
I'm very pleased to be interviewing Sheila Wilson, who was around at Bletchley Park, and also here is her goddaughter, Kate Dean. So can I ask what you were doing before you joined the Wrens?
Very simply, I was at boarding school in Buckinghamshire, and my anticipated career then was going to be on the stage, which was quite a common wish for lots of young women. And fortunately, I worked my way through it without actually joining the queue for unemployed actors. Mm. But I did have an audition at the Albert Hall Central School to be taken on as a student, and I was accepted. And then I made a decision just after I left school, and I made the decision then that I would actually instead do that after the war, but first join the Wrens, because I knew that if I waited for being drafted in one department or another, I wouldn't have the choice of being a Wren, and I wanted to be a Wren, not any other kind of serving in any other of the women's services. So I made that decision, took it, joined the Wrens, and actually never looked back, but did have quite a lot to do with the theatre one way or another in my later careers, though not actually as a performer. So the interest in theatre remains. I was called up in 1944, sent not to Mill Hill, which was a normal holding centre in London. They had some sort of infection. They wanted to keep that clear of new people. So I was sent up to Tullyhewan on one of the lakes in Scotland. Beautiful district, cold and wet, but beautiful. And I was there for 3 weeks. And while there, interviewed for drafting to a Wren job. And I was offered a job which I was allowed to turn down because I was quite young, 17, and was allowed to be given the choice of not working so far away. I was offered a job in Scarborough Flow in Orkney as a degaussing operator. And it's taken me a long time to find out what degaussing is about. It's about magnetic mines, I think. When I actually went years later to Scarborough Flow to look at the place that I had turned down, I found that in the museum, nobody there knew what a degaussing operator looked like or did. I wanted to see their uniform or what they actually did. I never did find out. Later on, when I became a film editor, I did have to degauss my equipment, so I caught up with it that way, rather than the story. But I was interviewed, and I suppose because I had some German, that's my idea anyway, I had German school certificate, which I'd taken the year before, and that might have been the reason why I was sent to Bletchley. I can only imagine that could be. But there were quite a lot of us. I think they did need a lot of new people, extra people at that time. 1944 was a kind of growth year for Bletchley after the invasion of Europe. That took place in June, and 2 months later I was at Bletchley.
Before you went to Bletchley, I presume you had no idea what the job was about?
Absolutely no idea. Absolutely no idea. I was quite intrigued to know that it was not to be divulged. I didn't know until I got there. I started in a building, the house was the name of the village, Wavendon. Was there for a very short while and then sent to Stockgrove. And they gave us a sort of induction, few days training in just the idea of what cryptography was, book codes and machine codes, 2 or 3 days just learning a little bit of what it was about. And I was thoroughly intrigued and delighted to be a part of this. And I remained so for the time that I was there. I worked in a department called British Plot, and we were told we were the only people in the whole place who drew their information entirely from British sources. And everybody else was involved one way or another in ultra material. We were not. We had to have the means to work out fairly accurately the whereabouts of any British ship or convoy or group of ships anywhere in the world, so that codebreakers could come in if they needed to and say, hey, what have you got in such and such a big position? Because it might give them a clue to the breaking of a particular message, which would be about a sighting.
Yes.
And I suppose that did happen. I don't remember it happening to me except once when somebody came running in, a young man came running in. Can you tell me the name of an American commander in the Far East whose name ends ITZ? And I could do that at once. And now I've forgotten the name.
Nimitz,
yes, right. And I only knew that name because I'd been reading picture closely before. I didn't know it from any private source or secret source. And he went away happy, so there we are. But it wasn't an interesting assignment. There had to be one of us always on duty day or night. And we took that very seriously. And the person on night duty had to write a bulletin about what had been happening at sea, which felt rather an interesting thing to do in the middle of the night. And I liked the people I was working with. I consider I was very lucky. I enjoyed the job very much. And the bit that I remember as being worrying and difficult was plotting the Russian convoys, British convoys that were leaving to bring supplies to Russia. And they left every fortnight in the most appalling weather conditions very often. I mean, they never came back intact. So I did have a very strong feeling attached to moving that little convoy on its journey towards Archangel or Mamance, because in the neighbouring plot just next to it, the U-boat people would have been plotting the U-boats there waiting to receive them. There was always a reception group of U-boats grouped around the entrance to those two harbours. And alas, there were fatalities very often. Yes. So that bit of it made quite a lot of impact on me. It remains, the figures with their white hats in the, if I ever see them in the assembling of the cenotaph on Memorial Day, I always think of that. I think of their bravery and the hazards they faced and how courageous they were in doing so. But it was really an enjoyable job. I liked the people I was working with. And as I say, I think I was very lucky.
On your plot, it was just the, it was the British and Allied ships. You didn't plot the enemy ships.
There were some French, there were some Czechoslovakian, there were individual craft that belonged to European countries, but they were mainly British. Yeah. I didn't have much to do with anything American, I think. Although we did keep a plot of the Far East, but we were mainly focusing, I think, on the European waters. And we had colours, and we had colours for the different, can't remember now what they were. The submarines were probably yellow and the corvettes were purple, I think, and the sloops were something else. So we could quickly see what path we were looking for when anybody came in to ask us. We as I say, took it very seriously. And I don't know anybody who ever even considered talking about what they were doing outside. It might have happened here or there, but I don't think it did. I think we were all carefully instructed before we began in our individual jobs, and it would not have occurred to us to disobey that instruction.
What were you plotting on? What sort of tools and equipment did you have?
Equipment, well, we had lots of little pieces of coloured card. We'd cut them out and write the name of the ship on there. We had pins, and we had wall charts, which I think were probably paper on some sort of matte background. We maybe felt, I don't actually remember that, but we would stick pins into the wall. Every day we'd have a huge list from the airport here of estimated positions at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then we'd know the speed and the direction. We'd have to work out where they might be by midday if anybody needed to know that. The plot showed what would have been 8 o'clock in the morning, that was that particular day, and then it would be changed next day. We probably had some sort of card index. I don't quite remember what we did there, but mainly putting them on the wall so that people could come in and see very easily if they were looking for a particular ship or task force or battle group or convoy.
And how did these positions come to you? Were they signalled from the Admiralty or something like that?
Just on a long, very, very long piece of paper, which was produced in Bletchley on a teleprinter and operated from... I spent a day once, I think, at Admiralty, what they call the Citadel, which is a special building they built in wartime, and that's where this sort of material would have originated. And it was sent by teleprinter. We also had telephones which could be scrambled, which meant that when you pressed a button, the theory was that nobody from outside could tap into that sound, it would be distorted. I never put that to the test. I don't know if it really worked that way, but it was supposed to be. I do remember, this is diverting a bit, I do remember on night duty once, there was an officer of the watch of the day, and he decided he was going to put to the test what he believed was a way of getting in touch with the First Lord of the Admiralty from Bletchley, his special code to get through to him. He might be in bed asleep, but he could still do it. And he decided he was going to put it to the test, and several of us stood around listening. In retrospect, I think this was rather unfair to a very busy man who needed his night's sleep. And I only heard one side of the conversation. And obviously there was something apoplectic coming from the other end. A very angry man who couldn't understand why he was being woken up. I don't know the end of that story. I don't know if this young man got reprimanded or not. Perhaps he didn't. But that sort of, partly he was doing it as a test, but he didn't really need to make that test. He was doing it a bit to show off, I think, and a little bit of a joke. And I think a lot of teasing and jokes did go on in Bletchley. I don't think it was harmful. It was letting off steam, and there were lots of nicknames, and it was a jokey place. If you went to the canteen or if you were in places where people were sitting around a bit, there seemed to be a lot of laughter and a lot of jokes, and that must complement the extreme seriousness of the material. We actually recognise the seriousness, but there was a kind of safety valve, maybe. And I think there were examples like that. We had some people there who were natural jokers, and one was, he was Angus Johnson Wilson when we knew him, but he became well-known after the war as a novelist with a particular form of satire, which is his strength. And then he missed out the Johnson bit, was just Angus Wilson, and became a teacher of creative writing. And he's quite a long time dead now. But he would have us in stitches very often, laughing. He had a great sense of humour. I don't want to make it seem that that was all that happened there. But I'm talking about the sort of atmosphere. We needed some way of correcting, I think, the extreme seriousness of the situation. We fully knew that, what was going on. And I knew, of course, much more then than I ever knew as a member of the public and reading all the newspapers. And in some way, I think this unusual humour was part of a release of energy. We had to find some way to bring us down to earth again, I think. I don't think I remember any viciousness in this, but simply a frivolity. Angus Wilson, I don't know what his actual job was, and you probably do know, but he certainly was working in the same building where I was working. And perhaps you want to remind me of which building that was. I think it was Hut 6.
I really don't know. I think it's a problem we often have because people say, well, which building did my mother or father work in? And of course, it depends exactly which bit of the war they were in doing that job, because like any big organisation, you move people around, you know, to make best use of your accommodation. And also, I suppose it had stopped by the time you got there, but earlier in the war, they were just building and building the huts and the blocks. Yes.
Probably by the time I got there, that might have stopped.
Yeah.
But I remember very well, I mean, I've been back a few times. I've been back to reunions and on a few occasions, not in the last 2 years. And, you know, it was quite familiar when I saw it. I think there were two stories to the
right
building where I was. I'm not absolutely sure of that.
In that case, it was a brick building rather than a wooden hut.
Well, it was quite near where one department, which had to do with translation, which was run by two brothers, who became quite well known after the war, I think, as one of them anyway, as a politician. Mm. I think they were South African. I can't remember their name now, but I did know one or two people working in that department. They would, of course, take on the text when it had been decoded and then turn it into good usable language that somebody else could then translate into English. Or perhaps they did the translation into English as well. And that was quite near at hand. And I was in part of a very big room where all the U-boat information was. And our little British plot was either in the same room or in the next room. I can't quite remember, but we could certainly see their charts as well as our own. And their charts would only have the U-boats on them.
I think you may have been in either Block A or Block B, which are still there now, for I work in Block A, which were mainly the naval section. And they would have been sort of big, you know, quite large rooms. The huts were quite pokey, so you probably weren't in one of the actual huts, probably one of the what we now call the blocks. But of course, we find this with a lot of people we interviewed. Because you worked in one place, you didn't really think this is Block B as opposed to Hut 7, because you just went to that same place every day.
I just throw in a question here, whether you've interviewed anybody else in this particular department.
Yes.
There are only six of us, seven of us or six, British plot.
Yes, we interviewed Jean Tocker.
Oh, I remember her name.
Yes,
very well. And Kathleen Payton, another one. Anyway, we became quite a close little network because we always had to, one of us had to be there. We had to stand in for each other. And I remember one big disappointment, something I had to get used to because life's full of that. I had been told that if you went to the BBC in Bedford, you might be able to get free concert tickets. So I wrote to Adrian Bold, who was a conductor in those days, and he very kindly sent me two tickets for a very early performance. I think it was the second performance of a wonderful opera called Child of Our Time by Michael Tippett. And I was thrilled by this. I was going to be able to go to Bedford, hear this opera, and take a friend with me. And then at the very last minute, somebody in my department had a family illness that they had to have leave to attend, somebody who was in hospital. Absolutely, no doubt at all, this had to happen. Mm. And I simply had to let go of the tickets. So it taught me a lesson. You can enjoy things, but you have to be able to let go of them too.
Yes.
I did see that opera later, but quite a long time later. Mm. It was a wonderful piece of work. So those things, sort of things, did happen. And in a small department, we took it for granted that we trusted each other. We knew that if we were asked to do something, there was a serious reason for it, and we respected that. What I remember about the actual work, the night work, the night watch person had the best job of all. That was the watch from midnight to 9 o'clock next morning. It was quite a long stretch, and it's a stretch where you get very inclined to sleep. There's a period of about between 2 and 3. It's very difficult to control sleep. But the thing that we mainly had to do was to write a report of everything that happened at sea. And I thought this was rather grand, a thing to do. It was tacked on to a longer bulletin. Ours was a sixth part. And there were all the other parts were had to do with ultra material, stuff that they'd been reading out of the coded text. But ours was based on British information. And it used to go to Churchill, and we used to think that's all the grand and all piece of work was going to be looked at. I don't suppose for a minute he read the war at sea, because he knew it all already. But the rest of it, Churchill did have a very, very high regard for what was going on at Bletchley, and took it very seriously indeed, as all of the other people who were responsible for planning and activity during the war knew that they wanted a very good thing. And we never doubted that what we were doing was in best interest of of the country as a whole. Although we didn't think in a high-flown way like that, but we knew that it mattered what we were doing. We took it seriously.
Did you know that Bletchley Park as a whole was about breaking the enemy's codes? Were you aware of that? Because your purpose was to, you know, plot the British shipping.
Yes.
But did you know that you were contributing to the wider work, which was code-breaking?
Well, of course, we knew what was going on there. We knew that the whole purpose of Bletchley was that texts were being picked up all over the world, as you know. I had a cousin in the Wrens in Alexandria. I later learned that that's what she was doing in Alexandria, picking up gibberish, literally gibberish, and having to write it down all day. We realised that it was of high significance and that we were a very small part of a very big puzzle. And there were other people there amongst my friends who were doing quite different jobs. Several of them were learning Japanese and would wake up in the night sometimes talking Japanese. It was a sort of pressurised course, which was quite hard work. I was longing to do that. I'd love to have learned Japanese, but I didn't. I was going to be sent out to what was then Ceylon, but the war ended just before I went, so I didn't, of course, in the end go. But we had no doubt at all that it was part of a very big picture. I never heard the name Alan Turing mentioned, but I understand from John Gallihawk that when I was there, he was actually in America and wasn't anywhere on the scene. And Dilly Knox, whom everybody talked about, had died the year before, and he had become a kind of folk hero in people's minds. And I'm greatly minded, and still do, that I never met him.
You mentioned before we started the interview, Frank Birch. Did you know him?
I didn't really know him. I knew him by sight. I mean, I was, you know, a very junior member of the team and didn't expect really conversation with the higher-up people. I remember some names. Commander Bacon was one. And I can't think of any other actual naval personnel now. But we knew who they were. We knew them by sight. Yes. And occasionally people would come in. We didn't always know who they were, but we, naval officers, we talked to them, of course, if they wanted to have any information. But the individual people that I remember, I think Angus Wilson was probably the main one who would now be considered somebody quite well known.
Yeah.
He was very carefully poised psychologically, and occasionally would have a little breakdown. And I remember that while I was there, he was discovered running naked round the lake one morning. It was time for him to have a little rest. There was a sort of first aid place. One of my Wren friends went to it for a fortnight. If we were noticed to be a little bit sort of overstressed or something, we'd be sent there for a brief rescue. I never got to that point, but I probably would have done if I'd stayed long enough. It was the war had gone on long enough. Because I think the pressure was quite extreme for some people.
Do you remember where that place was that she was sent to?
No, I don't, but I know it was in the area of Bletchley.
Okay, it was probably, well, either North Crawley or Crawley Grange. I think North Crawley was the village.
Yes, well, I remember that name, but I don't know what it was. Yes. I mean, I don't know what...
Yeah. Well, there were Wren's quarters there for Bletchley Park, but also there was a sort of hospital sick bay.
It was a little sort of sick bay kind of place.
Yeah, for exactly that sort of event, you know.
Well, my friend who went there just had a nice rest and could sit in the garden or something like that. And then she came back to work. I suppose some people might have had serious breakdowns, but I think this was more a question of the actual stress. There was a certain amount of stress implied by the free watch system, because you had to get used to very different sleep patterns every week. And that could be stressful. And we were a bit unwise. I can remember sometimes deciding not to go to bed when I got home at 9 o'clock, but go off and do something for the day. I mean, I remember hitchhiking on lorries to London occasionally. One of the things I used to do was to go to the National Gallery concerts, which were then flourishing. And then that would mean I would get no sleep at all that day, actually. I might have an hour at the end of the day. Would have to look as though I was surprised that I could hardly stay awake the following night. But you know, when I was 17 or 18, you'd think you could do anything and get away with it.
Yeah.
And the hitchhiking was a bone of contention, I think, for some of us with families who knew we were doing... My mother knew I was doing that. She didn't know what work I was doing. And she was quite worried about the hitchhiking. But I think that's another factor, that in those days, the amount of violent crime was much lower than now. Yeah. And people did have a common focus to a large extent. I'm sure there were criminals at work, but they weren't as obviously creating havoc as they might do today, I think, because there was some sort of feeling that that wasn't the thing to do at the moment. It wasn't the right moment for it. And the lorry drivers that I met were always charming and very kind and friendly. We just flagged them down in the road and that was it. I'm going to say what we were paid, because I can remember what we were paid. We would line up for it fortnightly. We were paid 10 shillings for a fortnight. And I think it might have gone up to 15 shillings at some point. But then everything was found, all our food, all our clothing, and that was pocket money. And it was worth a lot more than it would be today. And we got ration tickets where we could buy clothes, clothes ration tickets. And things like concerts and entertainment were usually free. I remember some events. We used to be shown captured German films sometimes, as an entertainment. And I remember a coloured film, that's unusual itself in itself, on Baron Munchausen, which is a sort of German folk kind of villain. Can't remember the story now, but all German children would know it. Baron Munchausen. He was a bit of a villain in some way, and he made this coloured film. We were shown that, and one or two other films, I remember. They were doing bought in from somewhere. Somebody had been able to help themselves from some German source. And then we had concerts. And I can remember the French composer Francis Poulenc coming with a baritone called Pierre Bernac, a lovely concert, rather like Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears would go around giving concerts in partnership. These two were doing the same thing. And we did get the benefit of visits of that kind.
And where were these concerts and film shows actually held?
Well, it's a good question. I actually have no idea. There must have been a room in the mansion, I think. Or was there a big hut somewhere? There must have been a hut where they would have dances. Now, I don't remember dances there, but they probably existed.
There was, in fact, still there, a building called Wilton Hall, which is outside, it's certainly out now, outside Bletchley Park, and that was built, I believe, for that sort of purpose towards the end of the war. So I wonder if it might have been that, possibly. But I've heard the mansion was used as well, so it could have been.
I actually don't remember, to be honest. Yeah. I just assumed, looking back, that it was some part of the complex of the associated with Bletchley Park itself.
You mentioned earlier on you were at Stockgrove. What was that like?
Well, it was a very pleasant house, big-ish rooms. If you're an ordinary man and not an officer, you always shared a room, and I think there were about six people in my room in bunk beds, but it didn't mean too crowded. It was a large room, and we were all working different watches, so it'd always be somebody getting up, somebody going to bed. We were always quite respectful of that. We had our own bathroom in that particular room, and in a way, we were quite sort of certain ways lawless. I remember if I were with some of my friends from that room, coming back at night, after night duty particularly, we were always quite hungry. So we'd go on the prowl and we'd start with the officer's pantry and we'd take any food we could find, like around marmalade, anything, take it upstairs and have a sort of feast. That's what I mean by lawless. Yeah. I don't think anybody suffered for it particularly. No. They probably had plenty of marmalade, but we were just rather hungry and we just helped ourselves and had a old-fashioned gramophone, and that was where I learned to love Mozart piano concertos. I used to play them over and over. And I was the youngest there, and I was treated as a sort of like a child, really, by the others, looked after rather well by the others who were mostly in their 20s, and I was only 17. And I remember it as like a sort of a family atmosphere, not particularly given to rivalry or anything like that. But the building itself was very pleasant. Big dining room. I remember that in certain seasons there'd be a big tub, a metal tub, full of wonderful Jersey milk, and that would be donated by the Duke of Bedford from the Woburn Herd, and he supplied all the Wren establishments with his top quality full cream milk. So we would take a mug and drink the milk, and it was delicious. That's a very small scale memory, but I remember it very vividly, and it seems to me quite a nice idea that the Duke of Bedford would supply us with that lovely milk. Their food was, I'm sure, good enough. What I liked on night duty particularly was that you had nothing but breakfast all day long, free breakfasts. And I've always liked breakfast the best of all meals, and I still do feel that. I think the food was well organised. I have no memory of being really hungry, seriously hungry, or seriously malnourished or anything like that. I think we had good people running the canteen, and of course in our individual houses we would have when staff who were trained as cooks. and we probably grumbled about it, but I don't remember it as being a serious matter at all.
So when you were on duty, did you eat at Bletchley Park?
Well, yeah. When we were working, yeah. We used the canteen at Bletchley Park.
Yes.
And when we were in our quarters, usually breakfast and supper, but we might be there in the daytime. The ordinary meals would be always available, depending. And nearly everybody there worked a watch system.
Yes.
And that meant either 9 to 4, 4 to midnight, or midnight to 9. Mm. And then you want about 3 or 4 days off at the end of that. And you could have a travel voucher. I remember we'd go somewhere like Oxford for a few days, or Bedford or something like that. We could all go home. Mm. We could do what we wanted within reason. But while we were there, we were fed by the establishment. Mm. And the canteen at, I remember, was being very pleasant and a nice place to go to, the canteen at Bletchley Park. We could always get a hot meal there if we needed, whatever time of day or night.
How often were you able to get home? Because it was home in London.
Home was, in my case, Kingston Town. Oh. My mother, who was by then widowed, running a business, and she lived there. And I would go home at certain times. Yeah. And I remember one of the factors, which very vividly, and I should think other people of my age might have had the same experience, that because we were doing secret work, which wasn't the case with most of the men, jobs in the services, we were not allowed to talk to anybody about it. And it was a wonderful way of treating it as a rite, I would now call a rite of passage, to be able to say to one's mother, no, I can't tell you what I'm doing, because she always liked to know. She didn't go on asking when she realised it was secret. She let it go. But I know she dearly liked to have known, and I was quite pleased not to tell her. There was a really good reason for establishing an adult point of view.
Yes.
I didn't have to divulge what I was doing. Yeah, I told her afterwards, and she was very interested after the war, but not before. I don't know if you've come upon in your interviewing people who admit having talked to anybody outside the concern. I didn't know anybody who would dream of doing that.
Most people say much the same as you have. In fact, many say, like you, they said, I can't tell you, and that was it. Because, of course, so many people at the time were doing things, you know, in the services they couldn't talk about. So
I can remember one of my friends at Bletchley coming in great concern. She was really, really worried. She'd been buying a tube ticket, and instead of asking for Hammersmith, she'd asked for Hammerfest, because she was a bit sleepy. And Hammerfest was a big U-boat centre in Norway, as you probably know. And she felt that she'd divulged something very serious, and she was really worried. Of course, the man selling tickets wouldn't have even noticed, I'm sure of that. But we took it that seriously. We were careful not to use words that we wouldn't use to a stranger. But she was coming off duty a bit sleepy, and it slipped out. I think I'd like to really add in, perhaps if you agree, to talk about what happened next. Mm. Because I don't know how other people would have reacted. I have new friends left now. I have had some friends, the last one died 2 years ago, who worked at Bletchley and whom I knew. So I have no friends now. But I think this question of learning how to keep a secret, was, for me, it was very important. It affected all the jobs, main jobs that I did afterwards. Because after the war, I became first a filmmaker, ended up film editor for about 20 years. And then I became a psychotherapist, Jungian psychotherapist, working with dreams a lot, secret language. And when I was working in film editing, we did quite a lot of government films, and we had to sign the Official Secrets Act. Some, not every film, but a few films were really secret. So I was already used to the idea of keeping secrets. In psychotherapy, you don't talk about what you're doing to anybody else at the time, because it would be breaking the privilege. So I found that that particular training, both in secrecy and in the question of secret languages or hidden languages, what I remember visually is in the U-boat room, when you walk through it, you would find little piles of neatly stacked pieces of square paper. On them would be rubbish, letters of the alphabet in a random sort of order. They would be the setting for a particular day, all stacked together. They hadn't yet broken that setting, so they couldn't be used. But they were precious because they were potential. And there would be a lot of these parts. Some of them perhaps never did get broken. So there was this question that was the assumption that there's meaning in what you don't yet understand. And if you treat carefully the material you don't know yet, because one day you will know it, possibly, and then it will be extremely valuable. So that idea went a long way into me, the idea that if you're working with dreams, for example, somebody's dreams, you may not know at once, they won't know at once what that dream is signifying. But you treat it with very great respect, because there's gold dust in there, and you, if you're lucky, you will reach a level where it would be of high value, and you treat it with high value. I'm perhaps exaggerating this, but it's the idea that you have a high respect for what you don't yet know, and you don't assume knowledge until you've got there. And that certainly came, or was the foundation for that was laid at Bletchley. The idea that there's a huge respect for the secret that you are about to learn, or may never learn, but hope to learn. I don't know if that makes sense, but I don't know if other people would have had that sort of feeling.
I've not heard it sort of expressed quite like that, but I think generally people knew they had secrets to protect, and they knew they were part of something much bigger than themselves, and they didn't know what went on in the next room.
Well, we all knew that right from the word there when we arrived there. I think that was in our induction days that would be conveyed to us. And we were young enough to feel this is more an adventure, and it's an exciting thing. And I still think it was an adventure. Mm. It was a very serious adventure, but it was an adventure. Mm. The fact that we were breaking certain codes of behaviour, you don't tell people secrets, you don't look over their shoulder when they're reading something private, that kind of thing. I believe I'm right in saying that in the First World War, there were even questions in the Houses of Parliament as to whether we should be breaking our enemy's code. Not in the Second World War, but in the First World War, that was still a question to debate. I suppose they decided it was okay because there was Dilly Knox doing it. I don't know if that point has been made before.
Yeah, I've heard something, well, sort of similar, in that I read a book recently about, it's really about secrecy in the British state generally, but a lot about Bletchley Park and that as well. And supposedly one of the reasons why Bletchley Park was kept secret after the war was that they didn't want the Germans to think they'd lost unfairly. Because remember the First World War, this myth that they hadn't been defeated in the field.
And it's a stab in the back. Word, unfair. Yes, that's a good word to use.
And so therefore, the Germans had to know they'd been defeated through force of arms.
Cheating.
Yes. So, yes, I think that's probably all part of that, yes.
I mean, it's quite a deep sort of resistance in some people to breaking the code, in that sense, the code of behaviour, not a different code.
Yeah.
So you're doing something reprehensible. Much later, when I was a psychotherapist, I was asked to give a paper. I could choose a subject, and I wrote a paper on the subject of the archetype of the spy. And I looked at certain spies, not only wartime ones, people who'd, for good reason, dressed up to gain information. Yeah. For example, the man who dressed, I think his name was Griffiths, in America, journalist, set himself up disguised before the freedom marches and the rights given to the black people. He travelled around in southern states experiencing the awful behaviour that was being thrown at them and at him because they thought he was black. And he wrote a book called Black Like Me. I used that book. And then I used another one by an Italian priest who had been concerned about the ragamuffins and after the war in Naples. And they managed to get funds together for these street children to give them a training. But in order to persuade them to go to this place to receive their training, he had to dress up as an urchin every night and gain their support, gain their trust, and finally expressed the fact that he had been cheating them. He wasn't really a ragamuffin, he was a priest. And would they then trust him? Would they come? And they did, because they trusted him. So that kind of use of the idea of spying, I took four cases, and the other one was Philby, who was quite the worst human being I think I've ever come across. I read what I could of what he had written of his own life to try and understand better what made him tick. And he was the one I really would hate to have met and had to talk with, because I think he was completely kind of corrupt somewhere. But that was much later. But I drew on Bletchley's thoughts to write the paper. And that was a useful idea.
I mean, I think one difference with what was happening at Bletchley Park, because I've thought about this, because you have all this controversy now about security agencies monitoring all your email traffic and not reading it, but just knowing who you're talking to. And I thought, well, in the war, that's what they were doing, and everyone thinks that's a good thing. But of course, there was nothing secretive about actually listening to it, because it was being broadcast on normal wireless, a normal radio. So anyone could pick it up with the radio. But of course, all they were picking up was meaningless groups of letters. what was being transmitted wasn't hidden, but it was what you were then doing it with it, you know. Yeah.
And there's a lot of that sort of stuff going on at a high level today, isn't there? I read the papers with interest when it comes up. There are some big decisions that have to be. Is one value more important than another value? Mm. And sometimes you really can't decide that ahead of time. You've really got to weigh each one very carefully. I think we have a moral nature somewhere. We have to get into the root of it sometimes to find how best to interpret what we're meant to be doing with material of that kind. But it remains a question. And I think Bletchley, working at Bletchley, even for the short period that I was there, a year and a half, something like that, left quite an indelible impression about giving it your best and really giving, not just taking automatic decisions about things, but really weighing them up and having a sense of the outcome of what you were doing being worth supporting. Yeah. And if it wasn't, you had to question whether you were right to be doing it in the first place. And certainly for me, I have remained feeling it was a privilege to be there. And indeed, I think it was a privilege to have been alive in wartime, because it brought us nearer to death, and we were much more, as a child, I was much more aware of that death as a possibility. People would say, what are you going to do when you grow up? Well, I might say, if I grow up, I'm going to do this or that. And as I think I've just explained, my wish was then to be an actress. It was a very strong wish. Luckily, going to Bletchley cleared me of that. But it didn't tear me of a love of the theatre and an interest. And when I was a psychotherapist, I had quite a few actors to work with. And when I was making films, there would be actors sometimes. So I remained very much in touch and enjoying being in touch, and still do, with the theatre as a source of inspiration. But I'm glad that I didn't have to plod around looking for jobs, because I don't think I would have been necessarily a very gifted actor. I don't know.
When the war with Germany finished, presumably your work finished.
It finished overnight. And the first thing, they had to do something with us, because there we were, a lot of Wren, with nothing to do. And what I remember they did with us straight away was put us into lorries every morning, a whole group of us, drive us to Denham, where there was a tomato farm. And in those days, maybe different now, I don't know, the tomatoes grew flat on the ground. And we had to pick the tomatoes, harvest the tomatoes in the sunshine. It was a pleasant job, sunny autumn, late summer weather. And on the other side of the field, there was a group of very handsome German prisoners of war. They were doing the same thing. And we weren't allowed to fraternize with them, or sorrow's size, whatever the equivalent is. We just also had to nod to them. Yeah. They had their picnic, and we had our picnic with nice fresh bread and cheese. And the other thing I remember was that there was a wall. On the other side of the wall was Denham Studios. And what was looking over the wall was a sphinx, a papier-mâché sphinx, a huge one that had been made for the Caesar and Cleopatra film with Vivian Leigh that was being made at that time. So it was quite a vivid memory. For several days, we picked tomatoes.
But Sheila, did none of your friends go over and ask for a light for cigarettes so that they could actually talk to this good-looking German?
Possibly, if we pushed the matter, we might have done. By then, the war was over anyway. We could have. I mean, there was nobody saying you mustn't talk to them.
Now, I've never heard the tomato picking story from anyone. This is new. Yes,
I got very badly bitten in the lorry. Sat in the straw, and there was insects in the lorry, and I had terrible wheals doubled up my leg from bites from some poisonous insect. But it was quite fun to do. The whole thing was quite fun. Yeah. That particular episode, the farmer gave us a nice lunch, and we were out in the sunshine. It's just a very vivid single memory. These men doing, they were probably much faster at it than we were. We were taking it in a rather ladylike, sort of half-serious way, but we were doing what we were asked to do.
But you didn't do this for long, because I think you told us before, this is going back some years ago when you filled the form in, you worked on Japanese stuff after a while?
Yes, as soon as the German war ended, I was switched over to a Japanese department, and I had to learn about Japanese submarines and their whereabouts and information that was coming in from the Japanese material, which, as you know, was book codes, not, as far as I know, not any machine codes. And it was quite highly developed, but much more by the Americans. By that period, I don't think it mattered that much. Everybody knew the war would end. We didn't know about the bombing of Hiroshima and so on. We certainly didn't know that. It ended it suddenly. And there's a whole other story attached to that, which isn't particularly my story, but I remember at the time being involved with a kind of moral aspect of do we drop the bombs or not. And I remember being very influenced by Lawrence van der Post, who had worked in Japan and who realised that unless we could convince the Japanese population that there was something celestial in this, a great big ball in the sky, they would be very unlikely to accept defeat because they were trained not to be defeated. They'd be killed rather than defeated. So he felt that the right decision was to bomb. There was a debate at the time about that. Vijay Day, I was in London. One of my Wren friends, if I now married, and had a little flat in Paddington. And I remember spending the night with her and then going off in the crowds next day to the celebration. That's as far as I could remember. But I don't think we got very far with Japanese submarines. I just had to learn the names of them and a little bit about how they were operating in that period of, only about, what would it be, 4 months or something.
I think what happened is that with the end of the war with Germany, a lot of people like myself were moved to work on Japanese things. A lot of the civilians, because they didn't belong to a service, they were just said, well, you can go home now. And then, of course, the war with Japan came to an end. And then most people like yourself said, well, we don't need you anymore. GCHQ remained at Bletchley Park until February 46. And then it relocated to Eastcote. Now, of course, Eastcote in Middlesex was where they had some of the bomb machines.
I spent a very little time at Eastcote, a fortnight or something like that. And I just remember a huge room with about 50 bunks in it, and a very big sleeping room. And I don't know particularly what went on there. I can't now remember, but I did spend a short period there.
But Eastcote itself became the new home of what had been at Bletchley Park. And then until the early 50s when they moved to Cheltenham.
Well, I think I must have gone there after the tomato picking, because then I went on in the Wrens. I stayed in the Wrens because I committed myself to 2 years. I had a year at Winchester at a fleet air arm station where they were testing radio equipment for aircraft. And I had my first flight there. And that had nothing to do with Bletchley, obviously. And it was just living out my commitment to being in the service. And then I was sent home at the end of that. So my story goes off radar now when that took place. But really the serious part of the war for me was the time at Bletchley when I really felt near the heart of things, because you were reading a lot of the signals but not actually act on most of them. But we had to read quite a lot that came through to pick out any naval material. So I did get an idea of the sort of awfulness. I remember one where there'd been a Japanese submarine blown up and somebody reported seeing bits of yellow flesh in the sea. How awful. And to call it yellow flesh, yellow skinned, they would have meant. It just felt very sort of creepy. But that was part of the deal. We just had to look through that material. It was an enforced growing up, I think, probably for many people of my age. We just had to adjust to. And actually, I think I was very lucky because I'd missed a draft in Scotland. I had got an acute kind of flu or something, a very serious throat condition, so they couldn't send me on the week I was supposed to go. If I'd gone that week, I later discovered I'd have been put straight onto machine codes, which is a very, very boring, important job, but terribly boring, just copying out numbers that meant nothing, yards of them, into the machine. And I didn't get that. I got my lovely British plot from having been ill in Scotland. I got an idea of how justice works in this world. It's not fairness, it's just good luck, quite a lot of it, or bad luck. Things like that you can't legislate for. But I remember that quite vividly. And I think probably other people's stories would fill in lots of gaps in mine. But I wonder if you find that other people have said that they felt the influence of having worked at Bletchley lasted a lifetime rather than a short period.
It varies. I think for a lot of people, because you know, you mentioned working on machine codes and being rather boring, which a lot of the young girls were doing. They knew it was important. You know, they enjoyed, you know, the camaraderie and, you know, the being away from home, but they didn't particularly get as much out of the work, I think, as you obviously did. And I think with a lot of them, because they then went back to, you know, normal life and, you know, went to university, got jobs, got married, whatever. And of course, they weren't supposed to talk about it, but more importantly, they put it to the back of their minds and they got on with the rest of their lives. And then years later, the story came out and they thought, oh, that's what I was doing, you know. And they turned to their husband and said, oh, you know, you always wanted to know what I did in the war. Well, you know, that TV programme that's just been on, that's what I was doing. But even then, of course, they couldn't really talk about it till much more recently when we started doing interviews and it was made absolutely clear that you are allowed to talk about it. So
you need to be honest. I can't remember ever knowing when I left the Wrens and went to Winchester and life moved on. I never remember knowing that I wasn't supposed to talk about it yet. don't remember anybody saying you mustn't do that. I suppose people vary to the extent that they're going to look for meaning in their lives, but I think my life has had extra meaning from working at Bletchley, and that's because I've wanted it to or allowed it to, and I've pursued the subject. If I go to a museum in once in Italy, I remember being shown a disc with some Etruscan dialect which hadn't yet been broken. And there I am wanting somebody to go off and break it quickly, but of course they don't. Sooner or later somebody will. But anyway, so that's my
thank you.
My bit of history.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. If anything crops up in the next few minutes, we can always turn it on again. Just like to say thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you for interesting. Coming. I can speak now. This is a PS, my guilty secret is being added on as a postscript. On one occasion, when I was the one writing the bulletin at night, I gave a report of a hefty task force on its way in the Far East to a, I can't remember the destination now, but in the Far East, we had battleships, two battle cruisers, a number of destroyers, quite a big force. And unfortunately, I got one digit wrong. So I announced the whereabouts of this particular task force. If you looked at the map, you'd find it was in the middle of Australia. And that went out on the bulletin. Nobody spotted the error. Next morning, one of my colleagues had to withstand a ferocious attack from a number of very upset naval officers. How could you announce a task force in the middle of Australia? No sea there at all. And I was very shamefaced because I should have checked it. And it was just one digit made the whole difference.
Thank you.
Here we are.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.